This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from San Francisco. Right now we're with Fernando Pujols, and he is involved intimately in the day-to-day and night-to-night lives and affairs in the Tenderloin. Tell us about the Tenderloin today.
Yeah, Tom, thanks for having me. As you mentioned, I'm intimately involved with the day and night in the Tenderloin. I'm the Director of Communications and Clean Engagement for the Tenderloin Community Benefit District. I have worked in the neighborhood for coming on 5 years now, and it's really my distinct pleasure and honor. I've been in San Francisco many, many years, and I have fallen in love with it all over again through the lens of the Tenderloin.
A few months ago, you and I walked to the Tenderloin, and I realized that you're basically, in some ways, a de facto mayor of the Tenderloin. Everybody knows you.
Well, I think you're being overly generous. I would not self-appoint myself the unofficial mayor of the Tenderloin. That distinct honor belongs to my good friend, Del Seymour. But you are correct in that everybody knows you. What I think many people might be surprised to learn about the Tenderloin is that it is a place where many of us know each other. We have banners that fly through the neighborhood, and one of the things that they say is around here we tend to know our neighbors. I have found, walking every day in the Tenderloin, that it is really the friendliest neighborhood in San Francisco.
That day that you and I walked to the Tenderloin, it was like being in a small town.
Well, it's one of the densest neighborhoods in San Francisco. Within 30 blocks, you have about 33,000 people, many elderly seniors who are traversing a little slower than some of the other residents. You have many, many children, so you hear their laughter, you hear their screaming as you're walking around. If you stand still at any point in the Tenderloin for a period of time, you'll inevitably see children, and I think that's a big thing that people don't realize. So you have families, and you have folks who are not of excess means, and when you have a concentration of people that are low-income folks, they tend to depend on one another and rely on one another, and that's one of the reasons, and there are a few others at least, that the Tenderloin has such a community fabric.
Looking from the outside, you hear many people that know very little about the Tenderloin, and you just say the name of the neighborhood, and the eyes roll, and the negative comments come out.
It would be disingenuous if I didn't remind some of the listeners that many of the things that they would read about the neighborhood would often come with a headline that includes the word seedy or gritty or dirty. And it is true that there are many challenges that the neighborhood faces, but I would say that nowhere in America is positioned to face those challenges the way the Tenderloin is. It's a neighborhood with many different waves of immigrant communities that have come and rooted legacies there. It is a place where people from all over the world, and I get to witness this daily through our Safe Passage program, but people from all over the world come together, they break through language barriers, cultural barriers, and find common ground. And it's a place where we can seek and find the things that bring us together as opposed to the things that draw us apart.
Talk to us about the engagement of the community members themselves relative to protecting, escorting kids walking to school.
Through our organization, we operate a program called Safe Passage. It was started by Tenderloin mothers back in 2008, who really identified a need to increase or perpetuate a culture of safety. And every day, at least 30 volunteers who come from the neighborhood residents, come into our office, they debrief, they train, they set up, and then at the after-school time, they set out and they strategically position on different corners throughout the neighborhood and create a safe passage for children, creating a positive presence. And they really invite everyone in the community to be part of that effort. We never tell anyone that they're not supposed to be where they're supposed to be or not doing what they're supposed to be doing. What we do is remind them that kids are coming through and that it's important to have a positive, friendly presence for them to see every single day.
Give us an example of community members, how they exhibit their community pride that you've observed.
Oh, man, there are many things that bind people together. We have a number of nonprofit housing organizations. We have social service providers. We have arts groups. We have arts venues. The creative spirit is very much alive and well in the Tenderloin and thriving. And so these things create opportunities or pinpoints for folks to come together and express themselves. It happens also in the small business community through the restaurants that are created that showcase different cultures from the neighborhood. They become a gathering place for people to experience one another's cultures. Just last night was the first Thursday of the month, and all over the Tenderloin and the Lower Polk neighborhood, different galleries, bars, venues open their doors for a monthly art walk. And so it's a way to experience the neighborhood. A couple of years ago, there was a project called the Hidden Gems that sought to uncover art happening in the neighborhood. And what they did was they found about more than 600 community members who identified as creative artists. And we're on the cusp of a round two of this Hidden Gems project. So there will be a whole nother effort to uncover and uplift some of that voice that exists.
And so out of economic necessity by default, the Tenderloin is an incubator for emerging artists, isn't it?
Well, absolutely, and it's also a place of healing. And many of these artists that were identified as part of that project that I mentioned really actually honed in on art practice as a form of healing and wellness. So it's very exciting to see. There's efforts around our open and public spaces. We have just celebrated this week the four-year anniversary of the renovation of Bodecker Park, which has become a symbol of what's possible.
Let's talk about back in the day. It was a very different park 5 years ago.
Yeah, years ago, you know, Bodecker was a place where it's rumored the police didn't even want to step foot inside. And today you go and you see, you know, seniors doing Tai Chi and walking around and getting their exercise. You hear children laughing. It was a true partnership of, you know, the St. Francis Foundation, the city, putting efforts into really renovating that park. But what has made it a stronghold in the community is not just the renovation that's made it pretty. It's the anchor programming that has happened through Boys and Girls Club, YMCA, San Francisco's Recreation and Park, our Tenderloin Safe Passage program, and all the community partners that have taken ownership. What's really exciting beyond Bodecker Park is that the other two parks that directly service the neighborhood, Sergeant McQuaulay Park and the Turkhide Mini Park, are also slated to receive renovations. And so we'll take the lessons of programming that happened at Bodecker Park and we'll apply those, just like we see the beautiful parks in Civic Center Plaza.
Let's revisit the big picture, because this is really an important story. I can give you examples of parks around America that are no-go areas for regular people, for families. You do not go there. But you took a scary park and totally turned it around. If you could distill the why to one answer, what would it be?
The neighborhood is really what turned it around. And I would say that any true positive, sustainable change in an area that needs improvement will not be sustainable if it is not rooted in the community and done by the community. Once the community takes ownership of that, then it's theirs.
Community pride and engagement, which by default there is policing.
I would say absolutely. That's the word. The word is pride, and it's neighborhood pride. You know,
But you as a neighborhood person have to be there, a physical presence, to be involved and engaged.
Absolutely. You have to. The neighborhood is not just at the park, but we see this in block group efforts throughout the neighborhood, people taking ownership of the sidewalk. They step outside the doors of their institution, their business, their organization, and take responsibility for what happens. What happens in the Tenderloin, though, is that we involve everyone, including our unhoused neighbors, folks who you may think on the surface are part of the problem, but you make people part of the community, and what you find is that they want to be part of the community, want to have responsibility, want to be held accountable, and that's just about human dignity.
My name's Peter Field. I'm a Tenderloin historian who does neighborhood history walking tours of the Tenderloin for City Guides. I was also a mental health case manager in the Tenderloin for many years in the 90s and early 2000s. It's what I do. And I have a book coming out on the history of the Tenderloin.
And the name of the book is?
The Tenderloin District of San Francisco Through Time.
An overview. What will we find in the book?
What you'll find in the book is a not so politically correct exploration of the history of this neighborhood from the days when it was nothing but sand dunes all the way up to the present.
Condense and encapsulate.
Do that.
The last 150 years in the Tenderloin.
Up until the 1860s, when the first public transportation in San Francisco, the first railroad rather, which was the Market Street Railroad, was built down Market Street and extended the length of Market Street past the, what was now the Tenderloin, but was then called St. Anne's Valley. For the first time, and for the first time connected what was then a little village with the rest of the street grid in San Francisco. And so suddenly there were reasons to come here more than just trying to get out of downtown San Francisco, which in the 1850s and the Gold Rush was a very dangerous and crime-ridden place back in those days. Now, the neighborhood was open for development and people just came on in. In the 1860s and 1870s, it became, and this one, Fernando, is going to really make your hair stand on end, it became a middle and upper class residential neighborhood complete with a number of mansions belonging to people you've read about in history books, like two of the Silver Kings. By the 1870s, San Francisco was expanding southwest. Hotels were starting to come into the neighborhood, most famously Lucky Baldwin's Baldwin Hotel on the corner of Powell and Market, where the Flood Building is now. And that began to change the dynamic of the neighborhood and who lived here. Then there was an office building right across the street, the St. Anne's Building, where the Bank of America building is now. So suddenly, there were transients coming into what had before then been a residential family neighborhood. And over the years, that changed the neighborhood, drew in restaurants, drew in bars, drew in people coming for entertainment. And by the 1890s, the people who had originally settled it as a family neighborhood had moved west to the west half of the Tenderloin and out into the Western Addition and Pacific Heights. And the east half of the neighborhood had become a hotel and entertainment district, and by the 1880s was becoming a vice district also. And by 1893, what had been called the Tenderloin in New York City, the name had migrated out across the United States. Remember, in the 1880s and 1890s, it was the era of the Victorian internet, the telegraph. Everybody and every city was calling its vice and entertainment and hotel districts Tenderloins. Started being called the Tenderloin in uppercase in 1893, according to the newspapers.
Going forward in time, there was the Barbary Coast that Fernando was talking about and how that got shut down and that created a shift in the dynamics in San Francisco, the population.
What happened was that the Tenderloin stayed the Tenderloin up through the earthquake and fire, though with everybody else it shifted into the Fillmore District for a time when all the businesses moved there, but speedily got kicked out of there because the residential district that was the respectable Tenderloin in those days was not prepared to deal with something like the Tenderloin. There, it was renamed the Uptown Tenderloin because it was now Uptown instead of Downtown. When it was kicked back out, back downtown again, it brought the new name with them, and they still called it the Uptown Tenderloin up until about World War I when it started to be called the Tenderloin again.
So modern-day Tenderloin, tell us about that, the roots.
It's a very, very complex problem. And the short answer is the reasons why the problems of today in the Tenderloin and the rest of San Francisco are so difficult and resistant to problem solving is because the causes are so multiple and various. But summarizing as much as I can, after the Korean War, San Francisco began to lose population, the only city in the country to have that happen to between 1950 and 1980. And as it lost hundreds, literally hundreds of thousands of people, the Tenderloin was one of the most drastically affected neighborhoods. Why? Because the Tenderloin had experienced a resurgence, an economic resurgence during the war years between World War II and Korea, because a lot of singles moved there, lived in the cheap hotels and like that. When all that work went away because of peacetime, those hotels emptied out. And by the 1950s, they were tearing down hotels wholesale to replace them with money-making projects because it was hard to make money off the hotel business anymore, the cheap hotel business. So between 1951 and 1968, there were about a dozen or so major rehabilitation projects in the Tenderloin that nobody knows about anymore because this has all been forgotten. It was things like the downtown garage at O'Farrell and Mason, things like the Federal Building, things like the giant PG&E plant at Eddy and Larkin Street, things like the giant State Building parking lot turning into the State Building. And all these projects people were so excited about them that even banks were getting on board. The Bank of America opened up two brand new branches in the Tenderloin in 1960 and 1963, where the mail facility is now at Hyde and Golden Gate, and on Ellis Street between Mason and Taylor, right across the street from where we're interviewing right now. This was looking so good.
So it was a renaissance.
They thought it was going to be a renaissance. And what the apparent assumption is, I haven't run across any writings yet to say what they were thinking at the time. What they must have been thinking was this was going to bring hundreds or thousands of people into the neighborhood, potential customers, to revitalize neighborhood businesses. It didn't happen. And as the neighborhood continued to spiral downhill for any number of other reasons, you can read about them in my book, it's very complicated, by the 1970s, the neighborhood had reached a tipping point where it wasn't going to get any better anymore. And by the 80s, when crack had hit the streets and homelessness hit the streets, that was the... And here's an interesting thing. The one group that has figured out how to make a living in the Tenderloin successfully has been the Southeast Asians who came here, primarily Vietnamese Chinese who came from Vietnam, but from other Southeast Asian countries also, open up businesses here. And because their primary customer base was their own people living in the Tenderloin, it only took the few hardy, adventurous, artistic-type souls who were willing to explore questionable neighborhoods to come and boost up that business into a profit margin. Other businesses have been unable to do that so far to date.
Would that not be a model that could be replicated by other ethnic groups?
It would be a model if you could move people in the neighborhood who would be a customer base. So far, that has failed to happen. Think about it this way. And here, I want to be clear. I'm a social worker. I'm a do-gooder. This is not a criticism. However, since about one-third of the hotels in the neighborhood are hotels designed for poor people, for disabled people, and like that, and most of the other two-thirds are cheap SROs designed for poor people, you've not got a population that has a lot of money to spend. Therein lies the problem. In the 1980s and the 1990s, when the Tenderloin Times, for example, was most active, the old neighborhood newspaper, they were all trying to figure out, how do we build up this neighborhood economically without boosting up its property values and hence boost up rents and kick out the very people who are trying to help and save the housing for?
Isn't that something that we're palpably have been witnessing right now in real time?
You're witnessing it right now, and it's not unique to San Francisco. This is something that's been going on for literally thousands of years in history. This is something that any sociologist, any cop, any newspaper reporter will tell you about.
But especially San Francisco is poster child for pushing people out from the low end to the high end because of the affordability of housing.
Well, and here at the affordability of housing, of course, is the major issue now. San Francisco is suffering from a glut of too many good things that have turned out to be bad things for the people who are already here. How do you deal with this? What you do is you deal with it one step at a time. For the Tenderloin's problem, which is how do you get customers into the neighborhood to spend money and help the neighborhood succeed economically without chasing out the people you're trying to help, is you put in place, and here I'm speaking as a social worker who's been doing this, spent most of my adult life working with homeless mentally ill. What you do is a combination of two approaches, which was written about weeks ago in the Chronicle, as a matter of fact, when one of the politicians, I forget who, was talking about how a European model works. And the European model is basically this. On the one hand, you offer services that are instantly available to people. And what that means is you walk up to a homeless person with a key in your hand like I'm holding up right now. You walk up to that homeless person and says, "Hi, I'm Peter. Who are you?"
Fernando.
I got a key here. You know what this key is for?
What's that?
It's a key to an apartment. Would you like to live in it?
I think I would.
It's yours if you'll come with me and get into a drug and alcohol program.
Let me think about that.
You got it, brother. So I go up to this guy, and he tells me, "You can blow it out your ear, pal," in rather stronger language than that. I come up to him maybe about a week or two later and say, "Listen, did you think about my key?" I send somebody else to make a try, maybe a better personality, a better match, tries at number three. Number four, a guy shows up, a social worker, this time with a cop. Hi, I'm so-and-so, and this is Officer so-and-so. I still have that key for you. And the officer says, listen, these guys are good people. I've seen them help other people. Go with these guys. Get into the program. They'll get you off the streets, brother. Guy, the fifth time, the cop and the worker show up. And this time, they say, we got the key for you. And the cop says, now I got to tell you that if you keep refusing, we might have to arrest you and put you inside because you're breaking the law for, what, camping on the streets, or we've busted you for dealing drugs before, or you're a public inebriate, or whatever it is they bust people for. The idea here is you offer a carrot and a way to motivate people towards that carrot, because for a lot of people, the carrot is not tasty enough unless you motivate them to get close enough to it.
And this is a literal example, a metaphor for something that you guys do.
And according to the Chronicle, the European model works about 40% of the time and gets just under half, so what, 40% of the people off the streets, mm-hmm. which is would be far, far, far better than anybody's doing in San Francisco now.
What's the best that's happening in San Francisco now?
Fernando's probably better equipped to answer that than I am, because his job is to promote the neighborhood, and he can see it through a more, for a rosier colored lens than I can.
What works the best?
In terms of
getting people off the street.
You know, certainly there's, we need to scale to a considerable level, and affordability of housing is a big block to being able to scale on many of those fronts. But what we do have are people like Peter that are very dedicated social workers and know that it isn't always the first time or the second time or the third time. Some of the most exciting work that happens in this realm in the Tenderloin is actually driven from peer to peer. So I would add a person in the equation that the metaphor that Peter gave us, which many people probably ascribe to, is that on one of those visits there might be a peer that says, hey, I've been where you're at, and I know it doesn't look right. We see that happen with our downtown streets team, nonprofit partners who are doing peer-to-peer outreach in the neighborhood and other neighborhoods as well.
And I'm here to validate exactly what Fernando's saying, because I myself was homeless for a year when I first came to San Francisco in 1970. For a solid year, I luckily escaped addictions. That didn't happen to me. But I,
where did you stay?
I couch surfed, I slept on the beach, I slept on the street a couple of times, any place I could find. It took me, who's in relatively good shape, a solid year to find my footing and get off the streets. Imagine how hard it is with someone who's disabled or has an addiction.
And earlier, I think I said that the Tenderloin is certainly with its challenges, as the entire city is facing challenges with this regard right now. I still strongly stand by the statement that the Tenderloin is the place to find the solutions to these issues. You have the thought leaders, you have the people who have the empathy, the dedication, you have the birthplace of the social justice movements, and people walking the walk every day and who are willing to put in the time to help one another. If we could learn from those lessons, and it is an exciting time potentially over the next couple years as we see this community effort to raise things like Proposition C,
which is
a citizen ballot initiative that passed with over 60% in our most recent election that seeks to unlock some gross receipts taxes to essentially expand our shelter wait list, as well as a number of things such as treatment on demand, which is time and time again brought up by experts as a very necessary component to address the issues that are happening on the sidewalk. And from an economic development standpoint, one of the places that Peter brought up, if we take it to sustaining the small businesses that exist in the Tenderloin, he brought up the Bank of America building at Golden Gate and Hyde, what became a sort of defunct post office in the Tenderloin. which is going to become a small business incubator where women entrepreneurs will have food stands and a food hall style concept with nonprofit La Cocina.
How far along is that project?
That project is set to break ground, I believe, this summer. One of the interesting things about that project is it will cater to tourists, residents, folks from City Hall who want to come over and have a drink and a good bite. But the other thing that they will do is offer community meals every day. So you'll have a $5 meal where Tenderloin residents with a little bit of expendable cash will be able to come over and mix and mingle and share time. There'll be a community room where family members can come and just host their own birthday celebration or something like that. So we have an opportunity to not just create economic opportunity for people to grow and harness their entrepreneurial spirit, but to be able to enjoy things in their neighborhood. And that's extremely important. Any business that comes into the neighborhood to think, not just how can I draw visitors, but what is the community fabric that exists here and how do I belong in that ecosystem?
And that brings me to a question I'm going to anticipate that you might ask, Tom, and that's that some people say that nonprofits are part of the problem and not part of the solution, and that they attract people, undesirable type people, to the neighborhood. Think of it this way. My historical analysis has shown that when the nonprofits started growing in the Tenderloin, which was when they really started taking off, was in the 1970s and 1980s, they brought in literally hundreds of employees to the neighborhood, employees with money to spend who need places to go for breakfast and lunch and sometimes dinner. Many, many restaurants, for example, or other businesses, found themselves getting at least profit, part of their profit margin or their entire profit margin just from these folks who are keeping their places going during lunch hours and like that. In addition, many of these programs took over rotting old hotels and either tore them down or built them over from scratch or rehabilitated them. And when they did that, they had tossed out, evicted the socially undesirable businesses that had been in the storefronts, like the XXX bookstores, the massage parlors, the corner liquor stores, and all the rest of it. And because programs like this typically will not rent to programs businesses like that, they bring in either better businesses if anybody's around who wants to come into the Tenderloin, or if there's not, it'll simply be a better front. And what happens, I cite the example of the Sisters of Charity, the Sisters of Mercy housing on Jones between Golden Gate and Turk Street, where the Yellow Cab building used to be. What used to be one of the most dangerous blocks in the neighborhood is now largely empty except for pedestrians. Now, it's not a total fix, because if you just walk around the corner to Turk Street, that bad traffic has moved over there. It hasn't gone away, it's just shifted. But the point is that it has positive effects on a block-by-block, lot-by-lot basis. And the key to it is not whether you can make that happen, because you can make that happen. The key to it is making those changes stick.
Interesting that Peter brings up a block-by-block basis. I mean, currently our organization is working very much on a block-by-block strategy, and it's really born out of the neighborhood. We've seen where community members really galvanize around their block. They get together, they start to meet, and they decide on what kind of actions they want to take. One of the examples started on the 100 block of Golden Gate Avenue, and some of the things that they were able to pursue were agreements with their neighbors. They improve facades in the area. They come outside every day at 2:30 p.m. on the first Friday of the month throughout the entire neighborhood now. We have an event called Four Corner Friday, where organizations and people come out and give each other popcorn or cookies or candy or just be neighbors. And be neighbors and be in community with one another. So
this is throughout the entire Tenderloin community.
That's correct. Today, I think there were 13 or 14 participating corners, and the folks that know me know I was not at my corner today.
And what happens with and what happens with what Fernando is saying? This program's been going on, Fernando, for what?
Three, four years now.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and one other major accomplishment of that group, I would say, was driving out a negative actor establishment. And not only did they stop there, but they wooed a beautiful actor establishment by bringing 826 Valencia, the writing and tutoring center made famous on 826 Valencia and the Mission, and now is a nationwide organization.
I'd like to flesh that out a little bit because you're making a really vital point here. The bad actor he fleshed out, I'm not going to name the business, but it was a corner liquor store that was a real bad actor and turned into a stolen goods drop too. What they do is this Four Corners program. Nothing annoys a drug dealer on a corner than a bunch of straight, good actors standing around staring at them and making them nervous. Now, the bad news is that after the Four Corners people go away, the drug dealers come back. But you do this often enough, and if it grows big enough, it's going to start to have a larger effect. And hopefully, the largest effect it will have is that it will grow to the point where it's actually worth the police's while to start busting people and keeping them busted, because maybe they might stop coming back again if enough is done about this.
That's what I was alluding to earlier, that self-policing of a neighborhood. That's a classic example of stepping up and stepping out.
Self-policing doesn't work by itself.
True.
Civilians are not equipped to do it.
Policing is not the right word. It's like Fernando was alluding to. It's more of that community engagement, stepping up and stepping out and standing up.
Tom, I'm going to agree to disagree with what you just said. I don't see policing as a negative at all. I see policing, when it's done correctly, as being a positive, particularly when it's done in partnership with community efforts to go on. So when it's done in partnership with the police are the guys with the backup to make what the community is trying to do stick.
Well, I think that's what I was trying to get to, that I don't want you as a member of the community to feel that you have to be a policeman, but you need to stand up and stand up.
One thing that's been a problem in the last 30 years of the Tenderloin's history is the police have gotten variable amounts of support from the community. And as any student of police departments will tell you, the police need a certain minimal amount of support to work effectively. And that's one thing that I believe the neighborhood should focus on in the way of supporting its own best interests.
In communities around America, what they've done in recent time is more community-based policemen that live in the neighborhood. Is that happening here?
In San Francisco, police officers are required to live in the city. Didn't used to be that case. And back in the 70s and 80s, I think it was, there was a big deal about this, and finally legislation got passed requiring that they live here. However, it doesn't specify which neighborhood they're going to live in. And the only police officer I ever heard of living in the Tenderloin actually lived on the northern edge of it. And that was, remember Bob Gary with his little dummy who was dressed as a cop. And he lived in the old Hotel Gaylord up on Jones between Gary and Post, right on the edge of the northern Tenderloin. But I've never heard of a cop living in the Tenderloin.
Well, I know some communities in America, they're doing incentives like free rent and whatnot and real inducements.
It's a great idea. I'd love to see something like that happen.
And to the notion of community policing, I think what we see in the Tenderloin and what I get to see every day, certainly programs like Safe Passage, is many, many community members who shoulder responsibility and act in partnership. And especially in recent years, we've really seen a great partnership from our partners at Tenderloin Station. A lot of it is about recognizing, you know, we're talking about officers not living in the neighborhoods they're serving. I mean, I think that speaks to the affordability crisis that we're having in San Francisco. And the Mayor's Office of Housing, I think, is trying to do some catch-up work on keeping first responders and teachers, folks like that, in San Francisco. But just as many of your listeners probably have a misperception of the Tenderloin before they get there, I'm sure brand new officers need a little time to understand that there's a community fabric there. And we do our best to make sure there's opportunity for those introductions. And, you know, we were just invited to bring a bunch of our resident corner captains to the police lineup. And so we'll be standing there with 150-some-odd officers, making opportunity for them to meet their community that they're serving, and vice versa. And there's no lack of appreciation in the Tenderloin. gratitude is a value of the neighborhood, and I think you see that every day. And we're very fortunate for the community policing officers that we do have. I'm looking at you, Robinson, who's out there every day walking the beat, engaging folks and meeting them. So it takes all of us when we talk about when Peter says that, you know, folks that are engaged in the drug trade don't like standing around people. We know through experience that if you're engaged in negative behavior, you don't like positivity around you. But in order to truly make sustainable change in the neighborhood, we're going to have to involve everyone in that work, including the folks that we think maybe are the problem.
Fernando's right about that. I myself, when I was working during one phase of my history project, when I was walking around the neighborhood photographing a whole bunch of buildings, and bringing a camera and photographing the Tenderloin is something you have to do very carefully. You can't just take pictures. You have to explain to people what you're doing so you don't get your butt kicked. I was doing this standing on the corner of Jones and Turk Street when I saw a cop was going by, and a guy, a street person, was walking by and said to the cop out of the corner of his mouth, "Guy around the corner is there doing a deal." And the cop pokes his head around the corner, sees it, looks at the citizen and says, and this is a street person citizen, somebody who to the average person would look just as much like a criminal as an actual criminal. And he said, and the cop says to the guy, "Thank you very much, sir." Walks around the corner and says in a big voice, "Hey, knock it off!" And the two dealers must have jumped about a foot and a half off the ground, stared at the cop, and then walked fast all the way down the street. So you are absolutely right. There are plenty of people in the Tenderloin who want a decent neighborhood, at least a safe neighborhood for themselves. It's just a matter of getting enough support to decrease the amount of bad behavior and crime in the neighborhood so that they can feel like this is working and I can live here safely. When that starts happening, the neighborhood starts looking good to other people, and that's when the real problems start happening and the property values start going up, and then the politicians have to get involved, God help us all, and start figuring out a way, how do we prevent this from happening and keep housing and the neighborhood affordable for people, since it's the only neighborhood left in San Francisco where that's still true.
Well, that is happening right now. It has been.
What's the question?
I don't remember.
In general, then, what I would like to see for the Tenderloin is, and for parts of the South of Market District too, is more services, more open doors, more beds, so that when the poor sweating social worker is walking those hard streets and comes up to that client and says, "We'd like to get you some services," instead of saying to the client, "Oh, good, I'll put you on a waiting list," instead we'll say, "I have the bed with your name on it right this minute, and if you'd like, I'll call a car, I'll go over there with you personally, introduce you to the staff, and you can see for yourself how you like that bed and if you'd like to claim it as your own." My name's Peter Field. I'm a retired mental health case manager who worked with the homeless in San Francisco most of my adult life and many years in the Tenderloin, and I'm now a Tenderloin historian.
And the author of a soon-to-be-published book?
That's right, The Tenderloin District of San Francisco Through Time.
Peter Field, thank you for sharing.
Thank you, Tom.
My pleasure.
Is there a question here?
Parting thoughts.
My name is Fernando Pujols. It's my distinct pleasure to serve the Tenderloin neighborhood every day. I work with the Tenderloin Community Benefit District. If you'd like to learn about the work we're doing, as well as things happening in the neighborhood, visit our website, tlcbd.org. And what I want most is for those outside the neighborhood to be able to experience the beauty, the pride, and the community fabric and the diversity that I get to experience every day. And for my friends in the neighborhood, it's just an honor to be their neighbor.
Excellent. Fernando, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Peter, thanks.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from San Francisco. Right now we're with Frank Meacham. Frank works at the Hilton Union Square in San Francisco. Also has some cross-pollination with the Park 55, correct? The hotel across the street?
That's correct. Oversee both properties, the Hilton San Francisco Union Square and the Park 55, a Hilton hotel.
And your official title is?
Area Director of Sales and Marketing.
Right here, it's really interesting. You're in the heart of Union Square, but you're also in an iconic neighborhood of San Francisco, the Tenderloin. right out the back door.
Correct. So I always say the two hotels truly have the perfect location in San Francisco. It's in the heart of San Francisco, in the middle of San Francisco. You're spot on with Union Square and the Tenderloin. And then the other neighborhood is SoMa, south of Market, where the convention center sits.
As a huge property, what's the largest hotel in the West, something like that?
Yeah, so the Hilton with 1,922 rooms is the largest hotel on the West Coast, minus Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. While our name is the Hilton San Francisco Union Square, we are the largest contributor to the Tenderloin, and we take that responsibility serious.
You are an integral part of the neighborhood, and even in employment, quite a few of your employees live in the neighborhood.
That's correct. A lot of our 1,600 team members do live in the Tenderloin, you know, and with a big hotel with convention space. So I always say we have two city blocks with close to 3,000 rooms and 170,000 square feet of meeting space, 8 restaurants and lounges, and there's a lot that goes on with them.
To be blunt, when we typically think of corporate America and corporations, we think of a heartlessness and a bottom line that drives everything. And you guys, you have to be bottom line oriented, but you're very much about give back to your neighborhood. Tell us about some of the ways that you do that.
First of all, I want to say, I mean, I think being a good neighbor and giving back to the neighborhood is good for profit too. Mm-hmm. It feels good, and the culture in the building contributes to the service that we deliver on a day-to-day basis. But to your question, to give back to our neighborhood, you know, if we have a luncheon for 1,000 people, but we only serve 800, we have our charities in the neighborhood that we make phone calls to, and you know, we have 200 luncheons that we can get rid of, and by evening, they've been served.
And where would they go?
So Glide sits right across the street from us. And in
that's Glide Memorial Church and a real homeless center, right?
Absolutely. They feed, I believe, 900 people for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And it's always fun to see our Queen Mary's roll across the street and go to good use.
But they love it.
Oh, absolutely. It's good food, and why should it go to waste? Yeah.
Give us some more stories.
So, you know, being a big group house, we do quite a few trade shows with exhibits. There's poster boards that come in, and those poster boards, generally speaking, would land in a landfill. We have partnered with an organization called Scrap. Whether it's buttons or whether it's poster boards or you name it, we donate it. We make sure that, you know, it gives an opportunity for second life. And it's actually fun to rummage through Scrap because, you know, we take our sales team in there, and before we know it, we say, oh, wait a minute, we hosted that conference and we hosted that trade show.
A lot of the end users of Scrap, they're educators, elementary school teachers, high school teachers.
Correct. So the teachers, I believe they have a day per week or day per month where they can go in and they can pick out anything for free and they use it in, you know, our kids' schoolroom.
Every educator I know, out of pocket, probably $800 or $1,000 each elementary school teacher or even high school teacher will pay for supplies because they don't have a budget for it.
Absolutely. I mean, I have a 15-year-old at home, and the teachers are saints. You know, we rely on them to give our kids good education, and the fact that they have to dig into their own pockets, you know, I think we all feel the same way about it.
A little bit more about the give back in the community and around the community here in the Tenderloin.
Yeah, so for the Park 55 specifically, we have a focus on the arts. When you walk through the lobby, it has a very cool vibe, and it's very fitting. So the Tenderloin Boys and Girls Club is an organization that we partner with locally here with the Tenderloin. And we recently hosted a 3-month exhibition with the Tenderloin Boys and Girls Club where the kids exhibited their art.
In the hotel?
In the hotel lobby. They actually sold a couple of pieces. I want to say it was between 6 or 8 pieces, which was very exciting. And it was fun to see the kids, you know, watch their own pieces go up on a public wall, and you know the transactions that happened thereafter, and their presentations at the very end. We did a little presentation, and everybody came back together, and just one example of how we find unique opportunities within our backyard. You know, another organization we partner with is Pride in San Francisco, and we put two very unlikely organizations together, and Pride and the Tenderloin Boys and Girls Club, and
Pride is what?
Pride is the is for the LGBTQ community. When you think about Pride, San Francisco, the parade in the month of June, it's actually the largest in the country. It's an important local community to the hotels.
What did they do with the Boys and Girls Club?
So in this case, they took 40 of their Pride flags, and they donated them back to the Tenderloin Boys and Girls Club. in 2019 towards the end of the Q4, basically. The Tenderloin Boys and Girls Club will present those 40 flags. They will utilize them as art projects, and they will be displayed at the Park 55, again, in the lobby area, for public viewing.
That's the fall of 2019.
That's correct. So two very unlikely partners coming together and, you know, creating something that is close and near and dear to our hearts here in San Francisco.
Your hotel property, in a way, is kind of the glue that binds, that brings people in the community together.
I think you're being very kind, but...
Well, bottom line, that's what you're saying.
No, absolutely. I mean, we have a lot of different partnerships, and I think part of our responsibility is making sure that we take someone like Pride or Frameline and the Tenderloin Boys and Girls Club or the Tenderloin CBD and making sure that there is a lunch and we have a conversation. Before you know it, there is an idea and it sparks the next, you know, activity, like the Tenderloin Boys and Girls Club having a Pride flag exhibit at the Park 55. I think there'll be interest locally. I think there'll be interest from our hotel guests and certainly hopefully from the press as well.
Let's talk a little bit about, as a tourist here, a vacationer, a hotel corporate guest staying in the Hilton Union Square or the Park 55, and they want to get out and do a walkabout and engage. Let's talk about culture, art, music.
San Francisco is such an iconic destination. You know, it's on many people's bucket lists to come visit. Obviously, what comes to mind is the Golden Gate Bridge and Union Square and Fisherman's Wharf and Ghirardelli, and the list goes on. But to your point, we do sit in the Tenderloin. Union Square is two blocks away, but the Tenderloin is on our backyard. What's fascinating about the Tenderloin is it truly is a theater district when you think about San Francisco.
It has been forever, right?
It has been. I mean, the arts have been near and dear to the Tenderloin, and when it's the music scene or theater, you've got SF Jazz, which is the only freestanding jazz-only building there is in the country, and they put something on like 400 different concerts a year, and absolutely spectacular. And it sits right here in the backyard in Civic Center in the Tenderloin. And then you also have the Orpheum, or you have ACT, or you have the Curran Theater, all renovated. And I believe you've got Hamilton coming to the Orpheum here in the Tenderloin. It's a happening scene.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from the Tenderloin District in downtown San Francisco.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com. Our associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, and Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkan Songs on NPR affiliate KUAR.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org. Once again, svdpusa.org. And whether you're shopping for new or used items, donating them, or volunteering, you're helping the Society of St. Vincent de Paul help others.